welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, UK's integrative cancer care charity, helping people with cancer to understand and access the many benefits of integrative cancer care to improve the quality and the length of their lives. My guest this week is Kirsten Chick, a regular on the show, although it's been a while since she was last on. Regular listeners will be very familiar with Kirsten and her always thoughtful advice on nutrition for cancer. Today, we're going to have a slightly unusual investigation into evidence-based practice and the ways in which it affects advice on nutrition for people with cancer. Kirsten, fabulous to have you back on the show. Been too long.
Lovely, Robin. Yeah, time flies, doesn't it? There's been so much going on. It doesn't feel like that long ago, but it's probably been more than a year.
And it's all this 20th anniversary stuff. We've been so full on. But anyway, all good.
Congratulations for that. I just want to take this opportunity to say, I don't know how you all do it, you and Mikel and the whole team. Just stagger me continuously with how much you managed to achieve. And you've just kind of done the Camino walk on top of all of the celebrations and conferences. Just massive applause to you.
Oh, thank you. We don't know how we do it either. We look at each other blankly and think, are we slowing down? Well, probably not. Oh, well. Anyway, today we're going to be exploring the arena of evidence-based practice in relation to nutrition. So I think there's going to be a lot in here, both for practitioners themselves of nutritional therapy like you, but also for those with cancer who are out there navigating the territory. I want to start out by going back to the roots of EBM, evidence-based medicine, which I believe were back in about the 1980s and 90s. It's actually, I think it's quite instructive to look at the original intention of its pioneers and then the way it's developed in practice. So can you give us a little potted history?
Oh, I don't know that I'd be confident to get all of my dates and names right.
just a general picture.
A little overview. So there have been various definitions over the years. I've read papers, more recent papers that have discussed the definitions and interpretations of those definitions. I think that something that really seems to come through, the common theme, is that there are three main tenets of evidence-based practice, and that is that we're looking to the research, the evidence base that is there, but it's evidence-based, not evidence-blinkered practice. So the three tenets are the evidence, the research that's there, but also experience. One's own experience,
clinical experience,
clinician, yeah, as a practitioner. And also, this often gets mentioned last, but I think it should actually go first, is patient preference and values. So listening to what the patient wants.
Yes. So very important, and really a picture that I think most people are probably not aware of. Those two of those are consistently getting just quietly forgotten. And everything is hung on the one. So it has, as a result, it's become very prescriptive.
I agree.
You know, I think in many cases, expert clinicians are merely doing what a computer tells them they must. And I think the originators of the idea were aware of the fact that there was all the potential for it to lead to cookbook medicine if they just followed the evidence. And I think quite early on, they quite deliberately gave it this sort of three-pronged approach in order to counter that. But in practice, two of them have been largely ignored. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think human nature is to want to be precise and definite about everything and to know the answers. And I think that's something that comes up a lot with research and evidence and science in general, is we mistakenly think that from there we can get the cold, hard facts. And if we're dealing just with cold, hard facts, we can't go wrong.
Right.
Now, the problem with that is that the cold, hard facts are not that cold and hard, and they don't cover the whole story. They never tell us the whole picture. It's just impossible. We'll go into that a bit more shortly, I'm sure. So we're left with a very incomplete and unsatisfactory and therefore misleading set of evidence that can actually lead us down a lot of false avenues and just not be very thorough or supportive or appropriate in what we're trying to do. So actually the other two tenets, the experience and the client preferences and values, are a really crucial counterpoint to that to help to fill in some of those gaps.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with what you say about this desire for certainty. And the science, you know, seems to me is kind of our best approximation of how things are at this moment. But actually, it's treated as though, the description I have come up with of science as seen by too many people is that, well, they used to think they knew, but now we know. And that's how they operate all the time, you know. And it gives this level of certainty, which unfortunately, as you say, leads to some big mistakes, very big mistakes, population-based mistakes, you know, all huge things go wrong with that approach. The other thing that's very much in my mind about evidence-based practice as it occurs, which is just one bit of it, is that there's huge business advantages to this. I think the pharmaceutical companies probably didn't like the idea of it when it came along in the first place, but have come to see that it's got enormous advantages for them along the lines of, well, it's kind of created a club that's so expensive to get into that they're the only people who can afford to get in. And it's a very quick and easy way of marginalizing everybody else. Because they haven't got a proper evidence base, you know. So forget about them. And it generally has brought in much more control into the whole arena. Huge amount of control has come as a result of evidence-based practice. I just think that it suited the business model very much. And along with that, it's created a vast number of problems that we're now dealing with where medicine is pharmaceutical medicine. There's no difference in the way that the BBC talk about medicine or drugs. They're the same thing. And the idea that curcumin could be a medicine is not on the radar at all. So all our medicines are toxic pharmaceutical products, which has led to the kind of mess we have in the NHS right now, I'd say. But
yeah, I mean, you're right, because if you look at the way that we carry out research, it is incredibly expensive. So it's really largely only the pharmaceutical companies that really can afford this. And to get a product onto the market can take years and huge amounts of money and resources, because first of all, you have to go through your preclinical studies. So you have to test things to, at the very least, what tends to happen, for example, with cancer medications is they get tested on mice a lot. And before they even get tested on mice, they might get tested on cultured cancer cells that have been grown in a laboratory and then on the mice. And it's only when they pass all of those trials that can take many, many years and huge amounts of money that they then get tested on actual human beings, which again, it's very expensive and have to go through various different phases of trials there as well. And there's one statistic I read a couple of years ago that really screamed out to me, which was about the amount of drugs that go through say they've been successful with the mouse trials and they go through to the human trials. 11% is a very, you know, some estimates are that 11% of those are successful. Some estimates are that far fewer of them are actually successful. So maybe as few as 5% are actually successful. So you've got to have a huge amount of money in order to put all of those resources in, knowing that they might fail. So you've got to then try something else. And that also means that a lot of the nutraceuticals and the supplements, the things like the curcumin, the quercetin, all of those kinds of things, may not have gone that far. So a lot of the evidence base that we're working with are the how they react in a laboratory, or sometimes how they react on animals like mice. But you can't completely translate that to humans. You really don't know how that's going to work in real life until you're in real life doing it.
Well, that's a very interesting point. That's right. And that's due to the level of investment in research in a natural product as opposed to a pharmaceutical. Yeah, very interesting, and something that you're working with day to day, I can see.
Yeah, it is to do with the level of financial investment in that kind of research. But it's also to do with the fact that all research has massive limitations in itself. Because you can only research a specific intervention, like a drug or a supplement or an activity, in a specific situation, in specific conditions, for a certain amount of time, on certain individuals that are in different life stages or disease or health states. And already we can see that there are some variables at play. But when you also think that each of us on this planet at this moment, and there are, I don't know how many of us are on this planet at the moment, but it's too big a number for me to even think about or comprehend. Each of us has a completely different body, completely different physiology, that's had completely different experiences up to now, and that is it also experiencing something completely different at the moment. The temperature, the humidity, the levels of stress, the clothes that we're wearing, the food that we've eaten, the interactions that we're having with our environment, with nature, with other human beings. All of those are different for each of us right now in this moment. And right now in this moment, they're different again. That's way too complex to bottle into any kind of trial.
It is. It's way too complex, which is interesting, because another whole point you're making is, well, what are we trying to achieve with trials realistically? What can they achieve? What should we be investing in? So, yeah, all good questions. And maybe we can make a little bit of a start here on reclaiming the full spectrum of considerations originally intended to make up evidence-based practice. So I wonder if you can speak a little bit about the role of clinical experience and patient values in decision-making.
Yes. So we can never be 100% certain in science. I think that's something that we need to be really, really clear about. And that might be quite scary for some people who that's what's keeping them just about stable, kind of mentally, emotionally, and so on, is this belief that what they're doing has some certainty behind it. And you take away that certainty and you can see the kind of fear creeping in behind people's eyes. But that it's really not all we have. It really isn't. It's not the only thing that should be holding us up. So in terms of experience, I think classically in EBP, that what they're referring to is the individual clinician's experience. So that might be the doctor's experience, the oncologist's experience. If you want to extend that evidence-based practice to people like me, I'm a nutritional therapist, then my experience. And we all, if we've been working with people for a number of years, we all have a great deal of experience to draw on. And hopefully, although I know this is not always the case, but hopefully self-aware enough to be able to appraise a little bit where our experience is actually bias and where it's helpful experience. And this is where we need to just really be questioning ourselves all the time. Just as much as I want people to question science, I want us all to be questioning ourselves all of the time. Is this really my experience, or is this just my perception of my experience based on my own what I want?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Can really, and as honestly as we can, draw on our own experience, there are gold nuggets in there. And some of the gold nuggets that I draw on are really paying close attention to how somebody is really coping throughout the whole process, from diagnosis through to treatment through to post-care. So rather than just thinking this is the diagnosis, these are the tools to support this person that I've been taught, that are in the protocols, I'm looking at that person thinking, is this what they actually need right now, this moment? Can they cope with it? Will it be too overwhelming emotionally, mentally, physically? Do they need some gentle, more rounded support first before we can just get in there? Or does their liver need some support, or their routes of elimination need support before we can just throw lots of different nutraceuticals at them, for example? Really paying attention. Or maybe they've started on some treatment and you can see that, you know, some people, you can really get a sense quite early on, yes, this is all working at the right pace for them. They're really thriving. They have a lot of vitality. They're feeling really positive. They're generally working through this very well. And other people you look at and you think, these people are drowning. And I know very few, there are some, but I know very few oncologists that will assess that and see that for themselves and then take action to change their protocols. I applaud the courageous ones that do.
Well,
and it is hard. I understand it's hard, but it's absolutely necessary to draw on our experience and go, okay, I've seen this before and I've seen this doesn't have a happy ending. I'm going to have the courage to change, shift the protocol, because I want to support this person in the individual place where they are.
Mm. Very interesting. So you've described one way in which an oncologist could apply evidence-based medicine as originally intended there. Maybe you could just say a bit more. Just say, okay, you've got the ideal oncologist who's embracing evidence-based medicine practice in the fullest possible way. But tell me some of the ways in which you would experience that as a patient.
Feeling heard, feeling seen, and just maybe, just having conversations about how is this going for you? Do we need to adjust the pace of your treatment or the type of your treatment, or to discuss additional support for your treatment? and actually be more open. In the world of nutritional therapy, there are lots of interventions that we can safely use through treatment to help cope with side effects, for example. And there is some evidence starting to suggest that some of these interventions may even improve outcomes. So really keeping an open mind and looking to that and not just dismissing with a, no, that's dangerous, that's not evidence-based, that's not what we do here, just stay with us, just stay with the protocols, that's the comfort zone. But actually looking out to and trusting other people's experience as well, which is also hard because, you know, traditionally there have been and always will be a lot of charlatans in the industry. It can be very easy to always be pointing fingers at the medical establishment, but there are a lot of people in the wider world of health and well-being who aren't necessarily, you know, in it for the best reasons. So I get why the medical establishment is really wary, but to keep an open mind, but that there are lots of us in this world who actually are authentic and doing our best and, you know, doing our research and trying to do our very best that we can to support people. And that's being supported a lot more within our own industries as well. So we can have a lot more trust in each other and a lot more trust in our experience, in my experience as well, of, you know, working with people going through treatment for 20 years. I get a bit of an idea of, you know, when to step back, when to offer something that I know is safe to support. I know enough that, you know, I've witnessed people doing really well because actually they've come really early, they've come before treatment. And now there's an evidence base starting to back that up as well. For example, with studies showing that or suggesting that the state of the gut microbiome pre-treatment may be having an impact on outcomes of treatment as well. So any work that you can do before treatment can be helpful. Knowing what's appropriate during treatment, what's appropriate and safe and helpful during treatment, and also where to step in and provide further support post-treatment. All of that, we've got a lot more experience and a growing evidence body around that now as well. And a lot of us have so much experience in this field. I'd like to extend that personal, this is my personal extension of the EBP.
Okay.
It's not just my experience and the experience of the clinicians involved, but we have generations of experience behind us that we can draw on. So we have the wisdom and experience of people that have written papers about this, you know, our parents, grandparents' generation, great-grandparents' generation that were, you know, trying to address some of these issues in history, in the past. But we also have the wealth of traditional Chinese medicine, the wealth of Ayurveda, the wealth of many ancient practices, herbalism, European herbalism, European approaches. There's so much wisdom and experience in there that we shouldn't be afraid to draw on.
Right. Okay, great. And I was sort of saying to myself that talking about what's on offer from oncology, if it's the kind of evidence-based medicine that's the one trick, one out of three approaches, it's a bit like telling people, all right, we've got this machine over here. We're going to feed you into it. Whoever you are, whatever your preference is, whatever shape and size you are, you're going to have to fit this machine. You know, the machine is in no way going to accommodate your particular needs, preferences, difficulties, or anything else. You're just going to have to tough it out. And it's pretty unkind and really not likely to be terribly successful for most people. It will work for some, but not for most, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But. So anyway, yeah, thank you for that whole description. So maybe we can come back a bit now to you with your work and how you like to practice evidence-based practice, working with nutrition. You've already mentioned an interesting point earlier on that, these days there's a mountain, actually, of evidence. It's growing amazingly rapidly, but most of it is kind of lab work and mice and all the rest of it. And so it's not the kind of evidence you like necessarily, but it's what you've got to work with. So I'm just interested to know how it informs your decision-making with real-world patients.
Yeah, so it's quite hard to keep on top of this. So I do my best, and there are some really great websites and databases out there that can help with this, but I don't 100% rely on them. It's important to keep on top of what we know, because it's changing all of the time. There are some nutraceutical supplements, for example, nutrition supplements that originally it's like, okay, you look at this and it looks like it might be fantastic. You know, in laboratories, in preclinical studies, it's shown to have really amazing anti-cancer properties. So let's use this one, and everyone's using it. And suddenly it's like, whoa, hang on a minute. Don't use it if you're having these types of chemotherapy, because it might interact. They both use like similar enzyme pathways in the liver. So they might affect efficacy of the conventional treatment. So, you know, hold back, stop using it. Or maybe it's, you know, too antioxidant for a treatment that's actually largely relying on pro-oxidant activity. And at that point, it's still theoretical. So, and then with some of those medications, when they start to carry out trials with or studies with human beings, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, maybe it does look like this is affecting the outcomes of the conventional treatment, so maybe we should definitely stop that. And in other cases, it's like, oh no, actually, maybe it's looking like it might help the conventional treatment. So I keep describing this as an exciting and frustrating time,
right? Yeah,
in science, because we've got, you know, there is this swell of actually science turning to look at all of these things, but at the same time, we don't quite know enough about how they're going to play out. So I'm quite conservative in my approach. I'm very cautious in my approach where I work, because I want people to have the best outcomes. So I'm always stepping back and thinking, what can I do? What can I know that will help that I'm as sure as I can be that is safe? And this is the thing in nutrition and in other therapies, there's so much that we can do that doesn't necessarily require lots of fancy nutraceuticals. We can actually have a huge impact just by going back to food basics and fundamentals, what we're eating, how we're eating it, when we're eating it. There's some lovely stuff coming out at the moment about chrononutrition, the timing of eating, and how important that is. And I love how that's starting to tie in with the Chinese clock and the Ayurveda timing principles. You know, that's what I'm saying about drawing on the experience of those that have come before us, because a lot of this stuff is already there. And then we have these exciting areas of research that go, oh yeah, maybe there is some.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at ukhealthradio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tena Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with a skin comfort formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So stepping back, thinking, okay, maybe I might not have these clever fancy nutraceuticals at my fingertips at this stage in treatment, but there's so much else I can do. There's so much else I can offer. And often actually it's the little tweaks, it's the little adjustments that can make all of the difference. It's the putting in rather than the taking out often as well. It's putting in a stable nutrition platform so that people's nervous systems and adrenals feel soothed and safe and nourished. That blood sugar is nice and stable. Little things like that can make a huge difference to mood and how people cope with what they're going through. And it can make a huge difference to some of the fundamental metabolic processes that are driving disease in the first place. And together with everything else, they can be a hugely valid part of the jigsaw puzzle, part of the, you know, what's going on here. So it's stepping back and really going back to basics and thinking about what does this person need right now. And part of going back to what does this person need right now is really listening to that person and helping that person listen to themselves. So what we're really getting back to here is patient values and preferences. So patient values and preferences is a broad topic, and it can include things like, you know, their religious values and preferences, dietary choices, how they want to live their lives, what's important to them, preferences like they would rather sacrifice this to gain this, or they would rather, you know, all of those things come into it. But it also can sometimes get confusing for the person to know what their values and preferences are, because there's so much information out there. As we've already established, it's quite hard for the professionals to sift through it all and make it meaningful.
Right.
So when you've got somebody who's like really new to this and hasn't had any background training and they're trying to figure out what's going on, and there are you know, articles and books and podcasts and all sorts of things saying you must do this, you must do that, you must do this, you must do that, it's a very confusing place to be. And it's very hard for the person in front of you to actually know what their preferences are in terms of all of this. So what I think our most important role is here is something that I know you talk about a lot, and it's about helping people to access their inner knowing, their intuition, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Because to really harness the power of that third tenet of evidence-based practice, the client's voice, the patient's voice, to harness that power, then that person needs to be able to really access their inner wisdom, their inner feelings, what their body and their whole being is suggesting to them. And that's a really hard people can get confused by this and think that actually there are like clear voices that are going to say you need to take curcumin three times a day. It's not that. It's that kind of thing that tells you that when you go to eat a salad on a day when it's snowing and your body's going, oh, this doesn't quite feel right. Or you go to eat a bowl of soup on a day like that and your body's going, oh yeah, this feels right. It's that kind of what am I drawn towards. It's so difficult to access those feelings and that inner knowing when you're in a state of fear,
right,
and shock, because fear and shock disconnects us from that. We have to really work hard to feel safe enough in our bodies again and connected in within our bodies again to hear and feel those kinds of messages. So a lot of my work is supporting that, and it might be referring people to other practitioners that specialize in that kind of thing, or it might be as simple as and for me these are powerful tools. Again, I mentioned stabilizing blood sugar and eating in a way and eating nutrients that help calm and soothe the nervous system and the adrenals, and eating mindfully, using mindful eating as a practice through the day, that's like a mini mindfulness practice that we can interweave into each day through eating a few, I call it three mindful mouthfuls at the beginning of each meal, just to help to keep practicing settling into our bodies and being present in our bodies, because it's from that place that we can start to feel where we want to go with this and what's important to us and what's important in our lives. And then we can bring that third tenet in much more meaningfully. And that will fill all the gaps, hopefully, or at least some of them.
How interesting. So we've gone from evidence-based medicine to intuition. I completely agree with you. It is that way that, the patient values and preferences bit seems to be hardwired into the way you work. I've known how you work for a long time. You seem to do it quite naturally. I don't know, is it something that sort of grew on you over time, or have you done it right from the get-go?
I think I've done it right from the get-go. I think it was just built into my training and maybe built into me, and just it's just I know you've referred to, and you're not the only one actually, you've always referred to me as the pragmatic nutritionist.
Yes, well, you know, I mean, it's notable in your work. You know, other people are much more prescriptive, and you're not. You're listening and you're tailoring and, you know, responding and all that kind of thing. And but you've gone on here to make this very important point. Well, you can't respond to somebody who actually doesn't really know what their preferences and needs are. And that's not uncommon, unfortunately, that people are like that anyway. I can remember being like that myself. And furthermore, give them a diagnosis of cancer and their level of fear, of course, goes through the roof. And they're probably less connected to their intuition than they would normally be used to. So there's a fair chance that you'll be dealing with a sticky situation where you're thinking you want to respond to their values and preferences, but actually they can't express them. So strategies to bring them back down to earth, get them standing on their own two feet again, understanding what those might be, are obviously key to actually being able to practice well in the way that you want to.
Yeah. And also there are two other patterns that I frequently see. There are many patterns. I mean, everyone responds to a diagnosis differently, but there are some kind of trends that you see. And another pattern that I often see is actually the client values and preferences, the patient values and preferences, if we're going to stick to the EBP language, are fear driven in themselves. So they're clinging on to things because their fear is taking them in that direction. So they're expressing very strong preferences and values, but actually once you work on dissolving the fear, those values and preferences shift.
Right.
So that's an interesting one to keep an eye out for. And the other pattern that is actually quite, you know, that I do also frequently see, and we need to acknowledge here, is people's intuition being sharpened by diagnosis.
Right.
Because that can also happen. And it's like, okay, I've had this diagnosis. I absolutely know how I want to deal with it. And you can tell that that's coming from a place of centeredness.
Right.
Not from a place of fear. And sometimes I say you can tell this and you can tell that. You can't always tell, but sometimes it seems pretty obvious. So I don't judge people on what they're expressing, and I don't try and steer them in any particular direction. But what I do is just keep offering opportunities and tools that they can have in their toolkit, and support in how to practice those tools regularly, not just have them in a drawer tucked away somewhere. But really support people in continually bringing their fear levels down and being able to get back into their bodies again. I think I'm not saying that I'm always successful in achieving that. And maybe sometimes I unwittingly do the opposite because, you know, I'm not this perfect practitioner. I feel strongly about this and I aim to do this as much as I can, but I'm sure I get it wrong as well. I do think it's the best thing that we can do for people is just keep that open space, that opportunity available to them, and help them just to keep calm and keep centered and keep focused and keep finding that place where they feel that, and then trust what comes out of that.
Right. So very interesting. So there's a lot of things you're looking at for there. You're looking at, in a way, you're looking at the people that come towards you with certainty. You're looking for, well, what's that certainty based on? Is it for real, or is it actually they're terrified and they're clinging on, like, to anything which they think might be going to save their life? So a very important distinction. But equally, well, the people who are much more vague and don't really know are very obviously calling out for support. And so you're looking to provide that support, obviously through your relationship with them, but practically through nutrition in some ways, I'm guessing, and also by referral to others. Nutritionally, what would you be thinking about?
Nutritionally, I'm looking to see how nourished they are and how nourished they feel. And in terms of food, because I kind of see nutrition as nourishment, so it's everything that nourishes us. But in terms of food, I'm looking to make sure that they have the nutrients they need. You know, I am looking at all of those fundamentals that every nutritionist, every nutritional therapist will be looking at. I am looking at meal patterns. Are their meal patterns serving them? I know this isn't, not everyone will agree with me with this, but I've always felt that for most people, a protein rich breakfast early in the day is a pretty important thing. So even people that are fasting, so maybe doing time restricted eating, overnight fasting, for example, doing it by having the early dinner and then, or the kind of mid-afternoon meal and then fasting overnight and still having that protein rich breakfast. I think actually, you know, the science is starting to back me up on that, but where I've drawn on that is my own experience, seeing how that advice pans out in people, and also harking back again to traditional Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and wisdom that comes out of those kinds of traditions. So that protein rich early breakfast often serves as a really useful platform to start the day on. It's like it's a message to the nervous system to say it's okay, we're nourished. And it seems to keep blood sugar much more stable, not just through the morning, but through the day, which helps with eating, like further eating patterns. So because it's helping keeping energy stable, it's helping to keep emotions stable, it's helping to keep everything calm, but it also means that people aren't getting those mid-morning or mid-afternoon dips where they're reaching for the sugar or they're munching the sugar through the evening and then giving themselves a really, really hard time because they're trying to reduce their refined sugars and suddenly they just seem to want more of them, which again is, you know, is as much an emotional thing as a physiological thing. So that protein-rich breakfast can be a lovely platform. It feels like when the shock and the fear of a diagnosis can pull the rug away from underneath your feet, I'm looking for things that can put that rug back in again and help that person feel connected and supported by the universe. So spending time in nature, having a protein-rich breakfast, for me, they do similar things.
Fantastic. Great. Well, look, all of that is a very good example of you exploring all three arms of evidence-based practice, bringing in your own clinical experience very much there, and obviously lots of observation of the needs of your particular client. Amazing. So I'm going to say that you're a supporter of evidence-based practice if it has all three arms fully working and implemented.
Absolutely. And just to take a moment also to point out that evidence-based practice, I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, it's often been used divisively. It's like, we're evidence-based, you're not.
Yes.
And actually, I'm pointing the finger in the other direction now, really.
Right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, I'm with you. All right. Well, fascinating talk. Thank you very much, Kirsten, for the chat and for suggesting the topic for today, which has been brilliant to get into. Thank you.
You're really welcome. Always a pleasure to chat.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye. It's always a pleasure to chat with Kirsten, and I always come away with some new perspectives. Do look her up at kirstenchick.com, where you can find out more about Kirsten, what she offers, and of course about her fabulous book, Nutrition Brought to Life. Thanks so much for joining me today. Please make a point of listening again next week when I'll be back with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.